So any of you who are familiar with, sort of core Buddhist teaching will have come across the term right view and wrong view. It's the first step in the Noble Eightfold Path, is the cultivation of right view. So these four distortions of view are actually what comprise wrong view. Okay, just to be clear on contextualizing that. So these four distortions of view actually provide the ground, the fertile ground, in which the anusyas grow. Now, this word anusya is most frequently translated as underlying tendencies. This is a way in which these kind of distorted views get manifested in certain inclinations of mind. And bearing back to the earlier discourse that we talked about, that what we frequently think about and dwell upon becomes the inclination of the mind. So these anusyas, or underlying tendencies, are actually the way the mind is inclined to take shape. Now, a friend of mine who's a very good Pali scholar actually translates this word anusya as the obsessions we lie down with. The obsessions we lie down with. Now, there's a list, as in all good Buddhist psychology, there is a list of these anusyas, which is well worth kind of looking at. The first of these is lust. This does not mean just sexual lust, by the way. This is craving. The second of these obsessions we lie down with is aversion. The third is views, ditti, the views that we have about the world, social views, political views, commentarial views, the views that we have about ourselves, the views that we have about others, you know, our general views about how things are. Mm-hmm. The fourth of these is the tendency towards doubt. This is, you know, pretty much a pervasive tendency. It can be practice doubt, it can be path doubt, it can be teaching doubt, it can be self-doubt. Okay, it's all of these views. The fourth of these is actually the tendency towards conceit. Now, conceit in Buddhist psychology is used quite differently than the way we use conceit usually in English. It's a conceit of self. It's a conceit of self. This is the root of our personal narrative. Much of it is the root of our personal narrative. The word in Pali for this is mana. And this is actually the relational positioning of ourselves. It's the way that I see myself as being better than you, superior to you. The way I see myself as being not as good as you, inferior to you. And the way that I see myself as being really the same as you. This is a really overlooked tendency in my experience in the teaching of the Dharma in the West, because it's one of the most powerful tendencies that operates. It often operates on quite an unconscious level. Many of these tendencies operate on quite an unconscious level. And yet this particular tendency of mana, or conceit of self, can pretty much govern everything in our lives. You know, if I see myself as being inferior to you, my aspirations, sense of potential will often be quite deflated. I will probably do a lot of comparing. I will probably do a lot of self-judging. It might mean that I'm the one who never asks a question in the hall. It might mean I'm the one who always sits in the back so nobody sees me. It might be the tendency that determines that I would rather be invisible in this life so I don't invite negative feedback. it'll be a tendency that leads to a lot of self-doubt, expected sense of failure. It will be a very powerful tendency. If I see myself as being superior to you, essentially superior to you, you know, I might be a very kind of driven person and very prone to cling to that which I'm driven to achieve in order to keep, in order to maintain a position of superiority. It might mean a lot of remoteness from people. It might be a pursuit of a lot of invulnerability. It might be that I've always got to prove myself. I've always got to show the world, you know, how much better I am than you, how much more I know than you. It might mean that I do a lot of defending and I do a lot of judging of others because I really need to show that I'm actually better than you. If I feel that, you know, my conceit of self pattern is about, you know, we're all the same. We're all swimming in the same sea of mediocrity, you know, then I'll do a lot of, you know, that kind of language. Well, everybody does this, don't they? You know, everybody's greedy, aren't they? You know, everybody's, you know, full of ill will, aren't they? You know, nobody can achieve an awakening. You know, that's not possible for anybody, you know. We'll have a lot of that way of actually both wanting to pull down those who we feel are kind of superior to us, you know, and we actually don't even notice the ones who feel inferior to us because at least we're better than somebody, even within this, you know, conceit of sameness. Another of the tendencies, the latent tendencies, is a desire for becoming. And this I spoke about earlier on today, the desire to become the kind of person who has a certain kind of experience in this world, generally one that is pleasant and unthreatened and safe and in control. The desire for non-becoming, this tendency is really the desire for annihilation. In its most extreme form, it's suicidal ideation. In its least extreme forms, it's kind of like, I just want things to go away. I don't want to be that kind of person who's seen to be distressed or unhappy or inferior. You know, I don't want to be that kind of person who's having this kind of experience. And the last of these tendencies is a tendency towards ignorance, a tendency towards not wanting to know. You know, it's very important to understand in Buddhist psychology there's always two aspects to avidya or ignorance. One aspect is, you know, a genuine sense of confusion and not knowing. And the other aspect that supports that is the not wanting to know. I don't want to know about impermanence. You know, I don't want to know about unsatisfactoriness. I don't want to know about non-self. So I'll do a lot of hiding in the bushes in pursuit of that not wanting to know, not wanting to be awake to how things actually are. So you can see that the distorted views have the propensity to be the breeding ground for these obsessions that we lie down with. You know, and in terms of, you know, a sort of uncomfortable awareness, in the service of cultivating an uncomfortable awareness, sometimes it's quite useful just to actually have a little study of this list, you know, and see actually which are the ones that are operating in my life most frequently, you know, which are the ones that I have the most expertise in, you know. Maybe I have expertise in them all, or maybe I see that I actually have more expertise in one rather than the other. This is all in the service of bringing about a greater sense of understanding and the places where we're actually asked to practice and to cultivate. It's not in the service of judgment. It's also quite useful to look at how these anusyas or these tendencies that we lie down with, how they interact. You know, because it's very rare that I think that one arises in isolation. This is really talking about a more complex psychology of how we build a world through these interacting tendencies. You know, if I have a very strong tendency towards doubt, you know, it's very likely that, you know, the conceit of self is going to manifest, you know, and always kind of arguing with everything or never having much confidence in anything at all or trust in anything at all. If I have that tendency operating, you know, it can trigger a desire for becoming. I don't want to be this kind of person who's always kind of lost in this soup of confusion, you know. If I have the desire for becoming, it might manifest in a lot of lust or craving, you know, because that's what I'm going to need to get in order to kind of console that doubt. So it's really useful to actually almost kind of draw this of a map of experience, a map of psychological experience. And how do I see this operating in my life? Because, you know, someone asked me the question before the break, you know, where awakening is found. Is it found outside of samsara or in samsara? It's found in samsara. It's found within these repetitive patterns. Remember that samsara actually translates as walking in circles. As walking in circles. You know? So we really look at which are the tendencies, which are the obsessions we lie down with, where we see ourselves walking in the circles, because actually that's where we practice, that's where we cultivate, you know, that's where we actually wake up and change course and learn that we can walk different pathways.
But Christina, aren't these tendencies, aren't they all impermanent as well?
Well, they're as impermanent as avidya, put it that way. They're as impermanent as distorted views.
Yeah. So they're not, yes, so they're constantly changing within oneself.
Okay, the question is, are these tendencies also impermanent? Well, of course they are, but they tend to be as long-lasting as avidya is lasting. You know, as long as distorted view is there, these tendencies are going to be there. They can change shape. It's like weather patterns in the mind. They can change shape. And yet if we translate these as the obsessions we lie down with, and we look at how repetitively we might lie down with some of these tendencies, we see the progression of them is that they harden into a self-view, don't they? I'm this kind of person. I'm a greedy type, or I'm an aversive type, or I'm a fearful type. And that's where actually it keeps, what you have to see is this is not a one-way street. So when those anusiyas or these tendencies begin to harden into a self-view, they feed back into the distorted view, don't they? Where I see something as permanent that is not permanent. So I actually see that I'm this type of person. You know, and I'm seeing that as being really quite permanent and really impervious to change. You know, I've always been like this. I will always be like that. You know, so when you see these, actually, I've got this. It is kind of a, you know, a developmental map. You know, as a sort of downward street, but actually, you have to really understand that the anusiyas are feeding back into the distortions. So even though they are obvious, clearly impermanent, and that's a great relief. When they're feeding back into the four distorted views, they actually have the appearance and the felt sense, more importantly, the felt sense of being permanent. Can you see how that operates, you know, in others or in yourself? Well, it is. The good news and the bad news is always in the same place in this teaching, in my understanding. Because what we're trying to do, obviously, with the practice, is to interrupt these closed feedback loops. You know, that's what mindfulness is really concerned with. That's what insight is really concerned with, is interrupting these closed feedback loops, where one of these is actually feeding back to reify and solidify and strengthen the other.